Support for the Marketplace Money podcast provided by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing the financial expertise that helps both our members and our communities thrive. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com.
Hi, I'm Tessa Vigeland. When someone hands you money,
you don't ask a lot of questions. You've made it. It's like, you're welcome to the club.
That's Monique Parker with this week's Marketplace Money Inside Quote. She says it's hard to pass up a good deal that offers you membership.
You don't ask a lot of questions. You've made it. It's like, you're welcome to the club.
So here's a quiz. What group did Monique join? Was it A, Toastmasters? The ability to speak well can pay off the next time you ask for a raise. Or did Monique become a member of B, the 69% of Americans who own their own homes? That number is shrinking because of the subprime loan crisis. Or is she a proud C, sorority sister? Secret handshakes and all, those ladies can serve as a great network once you graduate. Not sure? Stay tuned. We'll treat you to the answer with no hazing. It's coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From WAMU in Washington, D.C., this is Marketplace Money. The subprime loan foreclosure story just gets worse every time we talk about it, but the numbers can feel mighty abstract. So this week, we get personal. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com.
Here in California, we learned this week that foreclosures jumped 800% in the first 3 months of this year. Every week, almost 900 people lose their house. Today, we meet one of them.
We had a swing here, a barbecue grill, we had a basketball.
Monique Parker walked away from her home several months ago. She's a listener to this show. Back in July 2003, she got a $400,000 mortgage on a house in Long Beach, just south of L.A. Monique had spotty credit and ended up with a subprime, adjustable-rate, interest-only loan. She couldn't make her payments, so 2 years ago she refinanced. But that only made her payments higher, and she lost the house. I joined her in front of her former home to talk about why she bought something she couldn't afford.
My whole dream was to buy a house. I feel like if I have a house, I don't need anything else in life. I'm just done. That's just been my dream. But there was no discussion about what's going to happen in 2 years, because what they tell you is that you get the interest-only loan for 2 years. Mm-hmm. You're going to have all this interest to write off. So what you do is when you get your taxes back, you use that tax return money to pay for your mortgage. They don't tell you that it's really not that much, depending on what income bracket you are.
Did you think that you should have qualified for a $400,000 mortgage?
Prior to the subprime mortgages being a big deal, no, because we were really shocked. You know, when you go to these housing planning workshops and programs and they tell you that you really need to have so much money, they really mean it. But when you go to the lenders and they tell you you can qualify, that's the big thing. You feel like if you get in, once you get in, you're okay. Because you think, well, in 2 years, we'll be making more money.
So at what point did you kind of decide that we need to get out of the house?
Well, when we refinanced, I really at that point wanted to. But my partner convinced me, come on, let's refinance. We can do it. I'll get another job. And by April of the next year, I said, we got to call the real estate agent that sold us the house, and we put the house on the market. And that's when it just went crazy. I mean, when we set out to buy a house, people were buying houses without even seeing them. When we wanted to sell, though, 2 years later, there were so many signs and so many houses for sale, and the prices had been reduced. Our house stayed on the market from April until October.
What's it like to go through this process?
It was horrible, 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 because I have a degree in history from UCLA and half of two master's degrees, and I have a good job. I mean, our income was very good. It was just that almost year period of being laid off, and I just felt embarrassed, just really embarrassed. I mean, I was really depressed at work until my boss called her minister, who met me one day for coffee and talked to me and essentially told me that he had gone through the same thing and that I wasn't to feel that I was a scum of the earth or, you know, this derelict or something.
Who do you blame for this situation?
I feel like it's, I play my part in it because, you know, I'm at work. I tell people you have to know your rights. You have to know what you're responsible for. But it's a combination because before the subprime loans, it was really needing 20%. It was such a, even for me with the income I made, I mean, by myself, I make $80,000. So you would think someone who's college educated makes $80,000 a year, they would be able to afford a home. Along with my income, I couldn't afford to qualify for a townhome. And so with the subprime loans, it gave me an opportunity to get in. So for those who can get into management, I think it's great, but buyer beware. I would say get a lawyer and have someone explain it to you. Find someone, go through a housing program. Even if you don't qualify, it's not getting in, it's staying.
I have to ask you what you think of this for sale sign out here citing American Dream Realty.
Oh, my God. It is an American dream to own a home, and it was a dream that I always had. But it turned out to be a nightmare, and a lot of people, I realize now, are going through that. And I don't feel alone anymore. I don't feel so bad about it, but I'm better about it now. Before, I was just really, really down. I felt like a failure. And then I had to think about it and realize what I did is I made bad choices. Because, you know, if someone tells you you can't have something for so long, and then when they finally tell you you can have it, you qualify, you don't ask a lot of questions. You've made it. It's like, you're welcome to the club.
So what do you do now?
My biggest problem now is trying to rent, because not only do I have the foreclosure, but I have the eviction for not being here. And so finding someone, I can go say, yeah, I make $80,000 a year and I just got a promotion. I have good kids who are honor student rent to me. They're not going to. So I'm just not sure where to start.
So what would be the questions that you would have?
I want to know, how do I mitigate the foreclosure? Is there anything that I can do to help my credit? What's the best thing to do with the money I have now? I mean, I have a 15-year-old. Do I try to pay the foreclosure off? Do I invest in a 529 college fund? I have deferred comp. What do I do with my money with the fact that I have a foreclosure on my my credit?
Well, Monique, we'll try to get some answers for you, and thanks for letting us visit you here at your old home.
Thank you.
So let's see if we can get some answers for Monique. She's hardly alone in asking these questions. We've turned to Gabriel Del Rio. He's with Community Housing Works, a nonprofit housing assistance program. Gabe, now that Monique has gone through a foreclosure, what can she do to get past it?
Well, at this point, once a foreclosure has passed, there is some closeout to do with that foreclosure, and that would be ensuring that if there is any deficiency balance on a mortgage that did not get paid off, that the tax liability has been looked at and closed out in this scenario. When you don't pay off a loan fully, there is a chance that you will be forgiven debt, and when you're forgiven debt, that's a taxable as income. There is some calculating to do, I would suggest certainly with an accountant, because there's a basis to take off as to what your actual tax liability would be.
And how does she go about repairing her credit? What can she do?
At this point, it's about getting good history built today and going forward, and letting this bad history that's still going to be on the report for nearly a decade be in the past.
She's had trouble even getting rental units to look at her favorably and allow her to live there. Is there anything she can do in the immediate future to rectify that problem?
Well, I think it's always helpful, and certainly this is used in lending and underwriting, to write a letter of explanation. Basically, it allows you to add the human side beyond what you see in numbers on a credit report. And you have to find the right landlord, and I realize that that's difficult. She may also be interested in looking into some sort of assisted rental or affordable rental housing that may not have so much of an issue with that.
Gabriel Del Rio is Director of Housing Assistance for Community Housing Works, a nonprofit housing agency based in San Diego. Gabriel, thank you so much for joining us today.
No problem. My pleasure.
You'll find photos of Monique and her former home on our website. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Market Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans. Introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com.
If you borrowed money for college, there's a decent chance you owe money to Sallie Mae. It's the country's biggest student lender. Sallie Mae directly or indirectly funds about 40% of private student loans in this country. This week, some private equity funds bought the company for $25 billion. The deal comes at a troubled time in the industry. Sallie Mae and other lenders have been accused of some unsavory ties with college financial aid officers. So we asked Marketplace's Amy Scott to look into what it all means.
Next month, Chelsea Hamilton will graduate from Columbia University with advanced degrees in law and business, so she's no slouch in the brains department. But Hamilton needed about $250,000 in loans to pay for her education, and she admits she could have been a bit smarter about finding it.
I had never taken out loans before, and I had no idea what I was doing, so...
Like many schools, Columbia keeps a list of preferred lenders on its website. Hamilton says there was so much information and so little time to sort through it, she just went with the first lender on the list.
Given recent scandals, it seems like less of a good idea.
She's referring to an investigation by New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo. His office has uncovered some questionable ties between college financial aid offices and the lenders they recommend. Sallie Mae and Citibank settled for $2 million each, though they didn't admit to any wrongdoing. Cuomo's office estimates 90% of students go with a preferred lender. Columbia sophomore Gareth Schumacher is no exception.
I kind of scanned them and figured, oh, it probably doesn't make a big difference. But I'll find out when the bill starts coming, I guess.
The thing is, he may be right. Luke Swarthout is a student advocate with the consumer group U.S. PIRG. He says when it comes to student benefits, lenders offer pretty similar packages, partly because they market not to students, but to schools.
Whether those incentives are, you know, additional grant aid for students, contributions to the library, or in the case of the recent scandals, individual payoffs to financial aid administrators, those all have the effect of preventing a more robust market of loans. If we had a real robust student loan market with real competition, students would be paying less for their loans than they are now.
There are some things students and their parents can do. Find someone in your school's financial aid office that you trust and explore all your options. Take a hard look at that cheaper state school. Some families might take out a home equity loan to help pay for college. It might offer a lower interest rate than a private student loan. Most importantly, Swarthout says, have a serious conversation about how much debt you can really afford to take on.
The first instinct should not be to take out as much as you can in loans. They may want to look at other school options out there, other ways of paying for college. So I think there is a role for, you know, personal responsibility in this.
Lawmakers are pushing for more transparency in the lending industry. As part of settlements with the New York Attorney General, several schools have agreed to a new code of conduct. It prevents them from accepting payment for a spot on the preferred lender list. It also bans financial aid officers from accepting trips or paid advisory positions from lenders. Some members of Congress are pushing for similar reforms nationwide. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace Money.
Changing the funds in your 401k, Chris has the 411 in the mailbag, and the outrage over people who don't take time to savor their stinky cigar.
You know, it's like eating foie gras through a straw or something.
A day in the work life of a tobacconist. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Veglund. Not so long ago, just about every restaurant, bar, and airplane in this country had a smoking section. Not anymore, and most of us agree things are more pleasant that way. Less risky, too. Smoking can, well, kill you. But you know what? It is legal, and like lots of risky things, many folks continue to indulge. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, a purveyor of high-end tobacco makes his case for the business. He's a cigar shop owner and educator.
We're sitting in a humidor where we keep the cigars at 70 degrees Fahrenheit and 70% humidity. It's the optimal conditions for the cigars to be preserved indefinitely. My name is Jorge Luis Armenteros. I am the president and founder of Tobacconist University. Short-term goals, above all, I think, is to try and help elevate the level of credibility and professionalism and customer service, and perhaps above all, the appreciation of the product. I've seen people like the cellophane. I can't stand it when they try and mush out a cigar like you would a cigarette. I've seen people smoke the wrong end of a cigar. Ultimately, what I can't stand is to rush through a cigar. You cannot rush it. It will not allow you to rush it. You know, it's like eating foie gras through a straw or something. If you can help one person save their time better, then that to me is what we do. I'm originally from Miami. My parents are Cuban or of Cuban descent. First cigar, sitting on the front porch of my grandfather's house, some creaky, rusted rocking chairs like you did every night. And so I always had a fond memory of the smell or the time spent enjoying the tobacco. The cigarette is about giving your body nicotine. A great cigar is about the time you take to savor it. I borrowed $45,000 in the early 90s and opened this store in 1995. You can get a cigar for $3 or $4 and they go all the way up to $41.60 or higher. You have the La Aurora 100 Años, which is only about a 400,000 cigar production. This will be the last year. They'll never exist again. But this is not a business where you become millionaires. I mean, there are some millionaires. I'm not one of them. But you get into this business because you have a love for it. Over the last few years, I've put everything I have into the university. You know, anywhere from $75,000 to a couple of $100,000 a year. So what I make a year is $150,000. There's a range. It's more of a sort of passive aggressiveness that you see in people who pretend to cough when they walk in front of the store. And they're obviously being taught in school that smoking is bad, and there are definite negative health consequences to that. I just feel that so much of what we do has negative health effects, so it's hard to say what's black and white, right and wrong. I want to live in a world where tobacco is not anathema to the culture, but really just an accent. And an accent that, you know, maybe half of the population enjoys once a month, once a year, because there is something to it. Cigar making and entrepreneurialism and individual creativity are intrinsically linked, because you take a rancid leaf and you blend it with five other leaves, and then you have to have the patience and the lack of profit motive to wait for that leaf to develop and to do the right things to it to make it develop. Great cigar makers are far more concerned with their tobacco than any level of profit that they'll ever make, and so it's the product that matters, and that's refreshing to me in today's day and age.
A Day in the Work Life was reported by Ada Lee Halofsky.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrive and Financial for Lutherans. Introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com. And by the NASD Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at nasdfoundation.org.
Another student loan shenanigan brings us this week's Marketplace Money buzzword, National Student Loan Data System. It's a database full of personal and financial information about millions of students. It helps lenders figure out if an applicant is eligible for a loan. But it seems some lenders think it's a data gold mine. Recently, allegations surfaced that a number of them may have given marketing firms and collection agencies access to private student information. The federal government got wise to it and temporarily shut down the system, handing out a data suspension.
Got a box full of letters.
I'm Tessa Vigeland, and it's that time in the show when we turn over the mic to you and find out what burning questions you have for us. Us, of course, being myself and our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hey, Chris, how you doing?
I'm doing well, and hopefully I can quench people's thirst for knowledge.
Oh, excellent. But before we get to answering your questions, take down our website address. It's marketplace.org and click on the contact button, or you can give us a call at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. Well, Chris, you're always suggesting that our listeners educate themselves about personal finance by doing a lot of old-fashioned reading. Well, our next caller is a regular listener, and he's also a regular reader, at least all the books that you recommend. But, of course, he has a slight advantage. He's a librarian, and he's calling from his library in Virginia. Hi, Clint.
Hi.
How are all the books doing in your library?
Good. They're circulating well, which is what we like to see.
Good circulation is good for everybody, right?
Right.
So what's your question for Chris today?
Okay, well, my question involves my father's 401k plan. Mm-hmm. I would like advice on contacting the 401k administrator to kind of ask them to expand their investment options.
This is your father's 401k plan, but it sounds like maybe you're managing it?
I try to advise my parents on financial matters.
So is this 401k plan through the company?
The company approved it through their last union contract, but the union actually is the administrator, and they hire someone to actually run the plan, as far as I can tell.
Okay. So what is available in the plan currently?
Basically, all the funds are all load funds and no index funds, and they're all loaded funds.
Chris?
Is there a company match?
No.
All right, so let's divide this into two. The first thing is contacting the administrator of the union. You'll get on receptive ears. Whether or not they're going to change, I don't know. And I don't know how long their contract is. But I think it's worth the phone call. And I do think that one of the things of the Pension Protection Act of 2006 really has woken up a lot of administrators that this is exactly what they should be doing. And they should be looking at fees a lot more closely. There's a lot of pressure toward bringing these fees down.
Chris, it seems like if they don't go along with it, and this is a retirement fund that does not offer a company match, what would you say about getting out of the 401k and him starting his own retirement investment plan?
I would not get completely out of the 401k. It's automatic, so you don't have to think about it.
Couldn't you do that with an IRA?
I think they're both actually, both of my parents are actually maxing out their Roth.
Okay. Because that was going to be my other suggestion, that even though there's no match, they stay in with the 401k. Maybe you can get some better options in there, but they do get a mix of pre-tax money, but then a nice mixture with the Roth, that money, the gain will be tax-free when they withdraw that in retirement. Maybe they're paying too high a fee than they should, but the fact of the matter is they're saving for their retirement. It sounds like you've done a good job of setting them up in a balanced portfolio. Yes, it could be better, but your parents are in a good situation.
All right. Does that help you out, Clint?
Yes, that's great.
Okay, terrific. Thanks for the call.
Sure. Thank you.
All right. Let's reach into the email bag. You ready for a little electronic question here, Chris?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, Tommy from Middletown, New York, just learned of a very complex and somewhat frightening situation. About a year ago, his ex-wife helped their 17-year-old daughter get her first credit card. And she made minimum payments on it for a while so that her credit score was boosted. But then she started, of course, as we all know, getting other credit card offers. And what happened was she actually ordered these credit cards and, in fact, lied about her age to get more credit until she was $20,000 in debt in the span of a few months. So he wants to know, first of all, how the credit card companies can allow this to happen and not check somebody's age. Of course, I would guess that they don't want to check the age, because the more credit you rack up, the more fees they're going to get. And he's also wondering, given that she was a minor when all this happened, is she completely liable for this $20,000 of debt?
I just want to make one point up front. Why does a 17-year-old need a good credit score?
Good question.
I mean, that's my basic problem that I have with a lot of these credit cards. I mean, there are circumstances where it is important to start building your credit score. But for many 17-year-olds, it doesn't really matter. If it's your child's first credit card, what you want to get them, or what I would recommend getting them, is what we call a secured credit card. In essence, you have a $500 checking account, and it's linked to the credit card. Now, in terms of the specifics for this situation, depends how much money you want to spend and how much you want to turn this into a learning experience. But if it were me, first thing I would do is consult a lawyer. Once you have consulted the lawyer, you will contact the various credit card companies. You'll get into a negotiation.
So do you think it's actually possible that she could not be on the hook for this full amount?
I think that it is possible that through negotiation, you could reduce it somewhat.
Okay.
But you're going to be on the hook. It's a lifelong lesson. And I would say the one thing is she learned it at 17 and she learned it while you are there to help out.
Yeah, it's a lot earlier than some of the rest of us learned it, I can say from personal experience.
Well, usually we're on our own at that point.
Yep. Well, no matter how dire your situation might seem, it might have a pretty simple solution. Click on the contact button on our website. It's marketplace.org. Or give us a call at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. Well, as we've just heard, being a parent is really difficult. But, you know, Chris, sometimes being a child isn't so easy either, especially when you're like our next caller and you have to make some really important decisions on behalf of your parents. Deborah is calling from Boise, Idaho. Hi, Deborah.
Hi.
What do you do there in Boise?
I work for the USDA Forest Service. I'm a performance accountability analyst.
Ah, okay. Well, I understand that you have a situation with your mother. Tell us a little bit about that.
Mom had for years relied on a good friend to be her financial planner, and the woman was very smart about things. This woman passed away at the end of August, and shortly after that, my mother was hospitalized, and she hasn't been home since. She's been in and out of the hospital.
Wow.
And she's back in Cincinnati.
Oh, wow. So who is in charge of your mother's care at this point?
We have a healthcare power of attorney that my sister manages, but mom's coming up on the last few days of her 100 days for Medicare for a given event. And we hope to move mom out here.
Is your sister on the West Coast as well?
Three of us are in Boise, one's in Orange County, and one is in Montana.
Oh, wow. So nobody really near mom at this point.
That's right. If mom can get healthy enough for a move, we would like to move her in the near future to an assisted living out here. And I'm so overwhelmed with all the Medicare implications that her illness has brought to bear. And now with a different state, I'm nervous about what will Medicaid cover in one state, and is that the same thing in another state? It's just really difficult to know how much money anything's going to cost.
Right. And does she have her own home?
She does. It's been appraised at $150,000.
So, Chris, obviously lots of questions here and probably dependent upon other elements of her mother's finances, right?
That's right. I mean, there's a couple things. I mean, the big investment, and it sounds like you're already making it, is you've entered the world of Medicare and Medicaid, and probably particularly Medicaid. I think it's wonderful that you're going to move her. It sounds like that's what you need to do. And the reason why I raised the home is that this is an area that can get a little bit complicated with Medicaid. But it may make sense, depending on the market, to wait a little bit on selling the home. But you are going to want to sell the home in order to have that money available for her, particularly if she's going to move into an assisted living center, because that would certainly help out a lot with the assisted living.
Well, we do have a few other assets, and I had thought that I would liquidate and then try to get the house on the market in the near future, because some of my family have the benefit of a paid family medical leave. Others are given the leave but no pay. So I was trying to come up with a way to gift them some money so that we could go back every other week or so. And that's when I found out that, well, Medicaid kind of frowns on that if they see that you've gifted money within 5 years before applying for Medicaid.
Right. Now, I don't want you to spend too much. I think that is a wonderful idea. Unfortunately, there's a whole industry that has arisen, how to basically get rid of assets so they qualify for Medicaid. That's not what you're doing. So I would check with an elder care lawyer, and you don't want to play any games. You don't want to do anything fancy, but it seems to me this is exactly, you know, you're spending the money and your mother's spending the money. It's really her money that's being spent in order to get her healthier and to get her cared for. Because this is a different situation than trying to hide assets. What you're really trying to do is get her healthy so you can move her to Boise. That's a very different situation.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right. Does that help you out, Deborah?
It does. I know there's a lot of people in the same situation, so
Absolutely.
It'll be great to have this as a discussion.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for the call and best of luck.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, whatever your question is, chances are we've already done the research. So give us a call and let us impart wisdom onto you. It's 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. Or visit our website. It's marketplace.org and click on contact. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. And let's reach once more into the email bag. We've got Ashok from Raleigh, South Carolina, writing in. And he owned a piece of commercial property that he unwillingly had to sell to the city. I think we call that eminent domain. Well, they needed it to build an extra traffic lane so they can just come in and basically tell you that they're taking your property. But he wanted to make the best of the sale, so he obtained something called a 1031 exchange that's supposed to shield the proceeds from a tax hit. Can you tell us, first of all, a little bit more about that? What's a 1031?
Right. 1031 exchanges have become increasingly popular, and what you're doing is you have a four-unit rental apartment complex. You sell it, so you owe capital gains, but you want to defer it.
Okay.
If you exchange it for a like property that's used in trade or business or investment, you can defer your capital gain. It's a little bit of a two-step because you have to identify the property, and then there's all these rules that the IRS has for how you can do it and not run afoul of the IRS regulations, but it has become increasingly popular, I would say, really the past 10 years.
Okay, well then... then that kind of answers his question, because his plan was that he was going to use this money to buy a home. But what you've just told us is that if the land was originally commercial property, he can't use it to buy a residential property.
That's right.
So what options does he have then if he can't take this business and turn it into a house? Can he turn it into something else?
Yes, he can. Let's say he could turn it into buying, a four-unit apartment complex that I was using in an earlier example. There's a fair amount of flexibility. The exchange is for a property that is productive use in trade, business, or investment.
Let me ask you this. If he decided, given this advice, that he wants to instead just take the money, can he give that back and take the cash back, even though he has to take a tax hit?
Here's the deal. If it doesn't work, he's just going to pay the tax.
Okay.
You know, my theory is no one ever went poor paying capital gains.
All right. Well, that's all the questions we can take on this week's show, but leave your question for a future program on our voicemail. It's 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY, or visit our contact page on our website, marketplace.org. Thanks so much, Chris, as always.
Thanks, Tess.
Coming up, another installment of Educating RICO. Our hero learns an ugly truth of first-time home buying. Your parental units might not like your unit of choice.
It was going to cost about $30,000 to get the place up to the sort of standards that my parents, who live in suburban upstate New York, are used to thinking is how you should live.
And cleaning up on your recycling, one company wants to pay you more for your trash. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Perhaps you're one of the lucky people in the real estate market who's buying a home rather than getting kicked out of it. Good for you. You'll find it's nice to have someone in the know by your side to guide you through the process. In this second part of his series about home buying, our own Rico Galliano discovers how to be smart about picking a real estate agent and how to get that agent to really work it for you.
Last time, my pal Rick had just arranged financing for a new home. Since then, he's found a 950-square-foot loft in downtown L.A. He hasn't signed the papers yet, but he drove me over to check it out.
This is guest parking, and it's all full. I suspect... oh, that bastard took two spaces. That's not cool. A Mercedes, too. Oh, let's key that car. He can afford to get it fixed. It'll send him a message.
Anyway,
I'm sorry.
You can't blame him for being a little punchy.
Now, check this out. To buy a parking space in the garage costs $15,000.
What?
Now, when you roll that into a mortgage, and when you consider the place is $500,000, it suddenly doesn't seem quite so insane.
But it is insane.
True, but for a swank loft in L.A., $500,000 plus $15,000 to park is a bargain. In fact, finding it turned out to be quite a task, which brings us to part two of buying a first home, the real estate agent. A good agent works hard for the money. Over coffee, Rick and his agent, Jenny Gallo, told me about the search.
He wasn't sure exactly what kind of property he wanted, so I cast the net wide in his price range to show him single-family homes or income properties, a duplex or a triplex where he could live in one unit and collect rent on the other.
What did you end up finding?
An income property, two smaller craftsman houses built on one lot. Excellent price. It was probably about $50,000 under market.
And the last owner who had bought them in like 68 had made them incredibly butt ugly. Put wood paneling over every conceivable surface on the inside.
Including the closets.
And because of that, it was going for a cheap rate.
No problem, right? Except one. As with lots of first-time buyers in expensive cities, Rick's parents were fronting him a big down payment. And this home, they didn't like.
Long story short, it was going to cost about $30,000 to get the place up to the sort of standards that my parents who live in suburban upstate New York are used to thinking is how you should live.
So Jenny had to go back to the drawing board and came up with something the whole family could love.
This is my new loft in 2 weeks' time. It will be mine.
Yay, Jenny Gallo. But, you know, it was easy for Rick to find an agent of her caliber. He'd been friends with her for 10 years. How do the rest of us choose? To tell us all about agents, I've called upon Elizabeth Razzie. She's the author of The Fearless Home Buyer, which is what I hope one day to become. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi there.
So firstly, what can I expect an agent to do for me?
A good real estate agent will earn their very hefty fees. That's not just sending you emails telling you, here's what's on the MLS, let me know if you want to see anything.
What's the MLS?
Multiple Listing Service. It's a database where real estate agents post their homes that are available for sale and offer to share a commission with whatever real estate agent brings them a buyer.
Okay.
You want somebody who does more than just search that. You want somebody who will sit down, go over your budget maybe, and figure out, here's how much money you need for a down payment. They can help you negotiate. I mean, that's, I think, the most important part of the whole deal is having somebody to help you negotiate. Because once you fall in love with a house, it really helps to have somebody who says, okay, well, I think maybe the value is not what they're asking for.
Now, is there some resource you can go to, the equivalent of like a Morningstar rating for agents?
That would be a great thing, the J.D. Power certification of real estate agents. But there isn't such a thing, and maybe you can make a lot of money doing it.
Yeah.
There are web-based companies out there that will refer you to real estate agents, and they'll say, we've screened these people. You really can't rely on that because any real estate agent can sign up for these referrals. Really, the only way to find a really good real estate agent is the old-fashioned way, getting referrals from other people.
Do you need to narrow down your choices of like the type of home you want and the neighborhood? Will that help narrow the agent search?
What you want to do is get referrals from people who have bought a home that's similar to the one that you're looking for.
Okay, now Rick, as you heard, said that he wanted to cast the net wide. I actually know that at one point he was considering everything from like a loft to buying a prefab dome house and putting it out in the desert somewhere. Everything worked out okay for him, but it seems like you're saying that's not so great.
Well, everybody kind of starts there. You really need to spend some weekends just driving around because there is no real estate agent out there who can help you equally well with the dome in the desert and the little cottage by the beach or the high-rise condo.
All right. How are agents paid?
That's a tricky thing.
Uh-oh.
Generally, by the person selling the home.
Okay, now...
But that makes no sense, I know.
Right. Isn't that instantly a conflict of interest if you're a buyer?
Well, it should be. The problem is buyers tend not to have any money. And so the real estate agents look to the sellers. Take care to make explicit with the agent that's driving you around. Let's go through some paperwork if we need to, but I want you representing me and keeping my secrets.
You just mentioned if you want paperwork, you mean a contract?
You might want to sign a buyer's broker contract. And what you should do is make explicit that you want to see all the homes available. Homes that come up in bank foreclosures, you want to see homes their competitors' offices put on the market, everything.
Now, is it possible to get a good home on your own without a real estate agent?
Sure it is. But at the same time, especially for first-time buyers, it can be pretty tricky. How much should you put in the down payment? Who's going to hold the money? This all can be done without the aid of a real estate agent, but a lot of people really would like that hand-holding.
Elizabeth is right. For folks like Rick, a real estate agent is as much a psychological investment as a financial one.
It was this person who was this sort of window into it and made me realize it wasn't completely impossible and lots of people have done it. Because there's part of my brain that still thinks, like, I shouldn't be doing this because it is a massive amount of money.
Next time around, Jenny helps Rick cut the massivest check of his life and feel okay about it. In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
Sunday marks the annual celebration of our planet Earth. No need for envy, Mars. You've got a candy bar. Earth Day festivities come at a sour time, though. Americans are throwing away record amounts of garbage, more than 187 million tons a year. And we only recycle a third of our solid waste. But one company wants to boost that number by giving recycling a raise. Shannon Mullen has the story.
What if your garbage could pay for your morning latte? Or maybe a new fleece jacket? The Pennsylvania-based company RecycleBank wants to give you money to spend at Starbucks, Patagonia, and hundreds of other stores. All you have to do is give them your paper and plastic. They figure if they can get you to recycle more, your town will spend less on landfill fees, and their company can take a cut of that savings. CEO and co-founder Ron Gonen.
It's like telling a guy I've got light bulbs that take half the amount of energy. I'll put them in the building. If you give me half of the dollars, you save by using more efficient light bulbs.
In the case of paper and plastic, RecycleBank customers throw them all into one bin along with their bottles and cans.
We're really focused on making sure that recycling is as convenient as possible and as rewarding as possible by including everything that you can possibly recycle.
On trash day, the truck comes by, scans a built-in computer chip on the recycling bin, and weighs the bin as it's emptied. The heavier it is, the more RecycleBank dollars a household earns. So far, no one's been caught cheating the scales. The average family can rake in up to $400 a year. People can go online to check their account balance, get an estimate of the number of trees they've saved, and choose the stores where they want to spend their reward money. Some of the ones on the list are Hewlett-Packard, Petco, 1-800-Flowers. CEO Gonen says the partner companies get publicity and consumers get peace of mind.
We only accept partners into the RecycleBank program who have either demonstrated a commitment to sustainability or are trying to become more sustainable. So you're going to have an opportunity to spend your money at companies that really practice what they preach.
You know, in business, it's not usual where you can make money, be green, and, you know, everybody wins.
Bob Davoli is managing director with the Boston-based venture capital firm Sigma Partners, one of RecycleBank's biggest investors. He thinks people in this country will love the concept.
They're Americans. Give them money. Pay them. They're the biggest capitalist nation in the world. It's sad that we have to do that in some ways, if I wanted to wax philosophical. But at the end of the day, you know, it's certainly legal, and it's good old-fashioned American capitalism, but with a twist of helping the environment.
RecycleBank's pilot program in Philadelphia increased recycling rates that were 5 to 15% to about 50% in 1 year. The company thinks it can replicate that success around the country. But what about America's bad habit of overconsumption?
Recycling is a response to the waste we generate because of the things that we consume. And ultimately, the environment will be better off if we consume less.
Jennifer Howard Grenville teaches courses on business practices and the environment at Boston University. She praises RecycleBank's green business model and motives, but
what it does not do and what is a far, far bigger issue to address is how do consumers simply and conveniently do the right thing around changing their consumption patterns. And the problem is that that isn't simple or convenient.
So Howard Grenville suggests the company could also weigh the family's trash to see if they waste less as they recycle more. But consumption isn't bad, says RecycleBank's Ron Gonen. It's the type of consumption you want to talk about.
We're not going to financially reward you for buying styrofoam or something that's not recyclable. We're going to reward you for buying things that you can recycle, and only if you do actually recycle it.
RecycleBank is up and running in Delaware and New Jersey and plans to launch in the Northeast this spring. The area looks profitable because of its population density and the premium on landfill space. In Massachusetts, the city of Boston pays some of the country's highest landfill fees, almost $18 million a year. That's because Bostonians recycle only 17% of their trash. That's half the national rate. So launching Recycle Bank here could buy a lot of lattes and fleece jackets. In Boston, I'm Shannon Mullen for Marketplace Money.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
White House officials say the president
and the experts
is
say usually
the Heritage Foundation estimates
looks like it's going to be the best quarter.
They decide what they're going to charge.
That has some veterans nervous.
It's time once again for our economics editor Chris Farrell to help you sort out what's smart, what's stupid, and what is the straight story. Chris, you know, earlier in the show we talked to Monique Parker. And she had lost her home to foreclosure. Of course, millions of homeowners now in similar straits with this whole subprime mortgage mess. It's absolutely terrible. But I gather you have limited sympathy.
That's right, Tess.
No tears?
None. Now look, let's be very clear. I'm angry for low-income folks, especially minorities, that were sold risky, complicated, and even fraudulent loans. For them, the American dream of home ownership has turned into a nightmare on Main Street. But, and this is where I don't have any sympathy, for investors who knew what they were getting into, I don't want to hear any sob stories. Same goes for speculators that stretched to get a home so they could flip it for a quick buck. Now, instead of easy money, they're in foreclosure. And that's fine with me.
Harsh.
It is harsh, but listen, that's capitalism. Here's a straight story. Not everyone in this foreclosure debacle is a victim. No, some people gambled for quick riches, and they lost their bet. Caveat emptor.
All right. So you mentioned the word capitalism. That's what we're seeing here at work?
Right. I mean, here's an example. All right. Tess Inc., you're a subprime lender.
No, right. I wouldn't do that.
Okay, I'll do that. Chris Farrell Inc. I'm a subprime lender. Okay, we'll put it on me. Okay. I'm a subprime lender. So I'm going to be issuing these mortgages to people who don't have very good credit. But I need money so I can make the loans, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I sell some debt. I sell some notes, some bonds. So then I have money and then I can lend out. So these notes and bonds were going for about, for a one-year note, 13-month note, about 13%. 13%. Money market mutual fund at that time is going around 2%.
Yeah, why wouldn't you invest in the subprime?
Well, here's the thing. Hello, high risk? That doesn't mean that you're going to get paid.
All right, so do a little head shrinking for me here. Why is it that people keep getting sucked into this kind of speculation? You mentioned we had the dot-com bust. And then, you know, housing. And everybody said, this is a bubble, this is a bubble. There are problems here. And yet people still sink their money into what they think and assume is going to be an incredibly high return with no risk. Why is it that we as consumers and investors don't learn this lesson?
I think what happens is that you believe that you're, you know, it's like the Lake Wobegon effect. We can't all be above average, but you believe you are above average. You're going to get out before it collapses. You know it's going to collapse. The back of your mind, you know you're taking a high risk, but you rationalize it. And the reason why you rationalize it, because if you make it, you make some real money.
So can you tell us what the next bubble is going to be?
Oh, here's my forecast for the next bubble. Oh, this is my forecast for the next bubble. The word is private equity.
Uh-huh.
These are the gunslingers.
Yep.
The gunslingers, they have huge war chests. They buy a company with lots of debt. And let me tell you, there's too much money and there are not enough smart people in that business. And by the way, the innovators, the ones who built that business, guess what they're doing? They're selling out.
Oh, boy.
To me, that says the next bubble,
run.
Private equity, run. Be wary when a private equity firm says, hey, don't you want to invest with me?
All right. The straight story from our man, Chris Farrell. Chris, I'm afraid I'm going to have to run away from you now.
Okay. I'll talk to you later.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Thanks. Thankfully, the tax deadline has passed, but a lot of people aren't done yet, so they're going to need an extension. Tom Herman is the tax columnist with the Wall Street Journal. He says in order to get an extension, you still have to know how much you owe in taxes, and you still have to send the IRS a check. So what's the point of filing an extension anyway?
You're absolutely right. You do have to make an estimate of how much you owe, and the extension doesn't give you any more time to pay. It just gives you more time to file. The reason that a lot of people ask for an extension is that they are involved in partnerships, and a lot of those forms don't even come in until April 1st or shortly thereafter. So a lot of people figure, let's pay in roughly what I think I owe, but rather than have to do the return twice, I'll just get that extension and then pay what I actually owe later, and that'll cut down on time and headaches.
You can listen to the full interview with Tom on our website, marketplace.org. For the podcast, just click on the tax file link. That's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, life in the slow lane has its advantages.
We just had a semi pull around, and I'm just using a little bit of his draft with my motor off as he's slowly backing away.
So is his gas bill. Marketplace Money is produced by Wendy Sykes with Rico Galliano, Nancy Fargali, James Richter, Stephen Hoffman, Michelle Philippi, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. This week, special thanks to Francesca Segre and to Kenneth Mason and the staff at WAMU here in Washington, D.C. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at thriveq.com.
American Public Media.